So I think I might just pause there because I know there's probably a ton of things that Kevin still needs to say, and then also opportunities for questions.
Thank you, Cynthia. This is all about me. And this is very, very important that this notion of collaboration is recognized, because what I've found not doing MAID, but doing ethics around end-of-life care, is that when there is a very good, well-resourced, multidisciplinary, interprofessional team, that least worst death can approach something fairly extraordinary. And what I think is one of the most important things that I didn't learn until my father died is that anybody who's had a very near person die to them, and I think it's most powerful when you're there the moment they die, you take that death legacy with you through the rest of your life. You take it to your own deathbed, basically. And given that my father was the only person in our family who's died so far that is central to my family's life experience in that kind of way, the fact that all seven children were around the bed when he died, the fact that it turned into a very funny situation just before he died, which is very much telling about our family, the fact that we still talk about that experience over and over and over again, it was the best thing it could probably be for a whole host of reasons that I can talk to you about later. But it's that idea that we can actually help create and shape these legacies for our clients and their families and friends. And that's what's really important about trying to bring the notion of the highest quality end-of-life care into practice. So the other thing just to say about interprofessional collaboration around MAID is that there's this Carter carve-out, and we know that medical and nurse practitioners are specifically identified. It also specifically identifies the pharmacist and requires that the pharmacist who's dispensing the medication knows what the medication is for, so they can not have to experience an unwanted surprise at some point. But what it also does is it says, for clarification, no social worker, psychologist, psychiatrist, therapist, medical practitioner, nurse practitioner, or other healthcare professional commits an offense if they provide information to a person on the lawful provision of medical assistance in dying, which means you can talk about it, you can explain it, you can give people information, and you're not going to be held liable for some criminal offense that doesn't exist. And that's really important that you should know this. And what's interesting is we talked about all those safeguards and all those things that are pretty difficult to make sure you believe them to be true, like there's no undue influence. Nobody's pressuring this. Sadly, what is more than likely going to happen is that most people will be pressured the other way, not to ask for this because their families won't want it. But some people might be pressured towards it. But the law also recognizes that you could have a reasonable belief that the safeguards have been met based on the information the client's given you, based on the information other people have given you, and you might actually be wrong. But it says if you have a reasonable belief, even though you're wrong, you're still exempt from prosecution. But the documentation, of course, is what will demonstrate that your belief was reasonable. So it always has to be documented. And then the last thing that we've been talking about over and over again is the idea that the law says specifically nothing in this section compels an individual to provide or assist in providing medical assistance in dying. So that is your Charter of Rights and Freedoms conscientious objection opt-out, should you wish. What's important to note here, and we'll see how it pans out in time, it says there in the law, individual. And the debate often now is about whether organizations, institutions that are publicly funded can ask for an organizational opt-out. BC is just like the crucible of all these deep, deep questions. There's been some brewings around members of the board of Catholic hospitals resigning because they think it's wrong for the institution to opt out. That will remain to be seen what happens over time, and there's a kind of cordial cooperation going on at the moment. The trouble is where somebody feels that their charter right to request and be provided with this is interfered with by people who are objecting, institutions and even individuals sometimes. That's where it comes a cropper of the charter's limitation. So the charter says you have all these rights and freedoms until you don't. And none of them are guaranteed in abstract. There's always reasons for the sake of other individuals and public and society's well-being at large that those rights and freedoms can be limited. The other thing just to say is that conscientious objection is one part of it. What we're often doing now is referring to conscientious participation. Because hopefully this always brings some yuck, and hopefully it's always a little bit of a struggle with your conscience about, oh dear, is this the right thing for this person at this time? I can't necessarily know, but they're going to help me figure it out for them. You'll be participating very conscientiously. Everybody who does this, that I know at least, does it very conscientiously, even if it looks like they're doing it in a kind of laissez-faire way. So, that said, you can talk about this. The College of Social Support Workers and Social Workers in Ontario left a few of my colleagues feeling very uneasy when they published their interim guidance about this, because it kind of left everybody just not knowing if they can talk about this, because will it be considered counseling suicide, which is still a criminal offense, because it has to be, because sadly there are people out there who will do things like what happened to the woman in Ottawa a few years ago, about 5-6 years ago, Nadia Kijuji, who was very depressed, was chatting in online chat rooms about her depression, and was being advised by somebody that, probably, if you kill yourself, it's the best way out for everybody, for you, for your family, for your friends. And she waded into the Ottawa River in January or February during her first or second year at Carleton, which is well known, early university years for being highly stressful. Not necessarily Carleton, but everywhere. And so she was counseled to die by suicide. And that has to be an offense. And it remains an offense, except where the MAID criteria are met and safeguards are met. So that's where you step in this position. So should you end up stepping in and helping some of your esteemed colleagues work around this with somebody, what might an OT offer? This is what OTs across the country said. We offered them just the things we could think of at first, and they ticked all these boxes. So biggest thing is tying up life roles, which makes beautiful sense. And then other things like helping make memories. Actually, I'm wrong. This is your responses, I believe. Things like helping people explore the alternatives. So if you can offer some way to make it a little bit more bearable for a little bit longer, somebody might live another week and get another week out of life, maybe even a month. Who knows? And then planning with the team, with the family, with the client. And capacity assessment is another thing that very often is done as a collaborative endeavor. And in this case, it's ultimately going to be the medical or nurse practitioners involved who will have to testify, basically, verify that and document that this person's capable. But given that you see clients do things in different ways, in different contexts, in different kinds of activities, you can get a sense of the way they're talking about this. And if you feel that there's anything that you think they have misunderstood, and you can share that, and that's very good. In other end-of-life care situations, what might you do? Well, the list that you identified is pretty much the same. This is not applying things very differently in terms of practice skills. It's just recognizing that this is to a different goal of care that the client has identified. So it's still very much in keeping with what you would be expecting to do in end-of-life care. It's just a different goal that the client has decided is the best one for them. Some of the other things that you said about MAID. As much as I lament this association with the word suicide, I feel I end up needing to address it regularly, particularly having just been for 2 years working at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where suicide prevention is a massive thing. Trying to get people to understand that this is different to what we typically refer to as suicide, which is a crisis-driven, typically, response that is not supported particularly well by anybody in the moment. It's something very different. So I asked you if you thought it was different clinically. And you said yes, pretty much. The trouble with it is, most of us also know people who may have died by suicide, and there may be one or two people in those stories that we've encountered where we actually think it's perhaps this thing called rational suicide, that this person's life was, for decades, not actually getting much better despite endless attempts for improvement through treatments. And some people in mental health will talk about palliative psychiatry and the idea that you reach a point where everything is exhausted and we have nothing left to offer, and maybe the only way for the person to escape their symptoms is actually to end the symptoms altogether by ending their life. And some people will argue, and other people will dispute it, that that's possible. That's not on the table in our context, because the person has to have a naturally foreseeable death in the reasonable future. You also said things like it's related to having informed options, the difference. Some people felt that it was just a matter of semantics, and it's the same thing, and assisted suicide, assisted death just sounds better. I have a clinical responsibility to prevent harm to self or others. MAID is a process rather than a decision, a reaction rather, which is the way that I would usually see it. Suicide is not a last resort after all other medical options fail us, which is what this person, I think, felt assisted dying is. And what will happen when we stop thinking about suicide as a cry for help and accept it as okay? And that's what we should never do. Every request for assisted dying needs to be explored as basically a statement that this isn't working for me the way we're doing it now, and what else can we do? And does this mean that some suicide is actually okay? And some people will argue that some suicide is probably okay. And I have a very thick book I'm trying to read at the moment called Rational Suicide, Irrational Laws. And it's fascinating reading. Is it morally different? I have no idea what this question was trying to ask. All I know is that I wanted to ask the question and get you just to think about what that means to you when you see those words. So none of these results are ready to be taken with anything more than oh, that's curious. What does that mean? What do I think about that? So not surprisingly, it's much smaller. But what's interesting is a lot of people said things like, I believe I feel tremendous sadness, but it's not wrong. So morally, even a suicide that's one of those crisis things, we tend not to think judgmentally, morally about it. It's no longer a criminal offense to die by your own hand or to attempt to, which it was until some decades ago. Sometimes life becomes too difficult to bear, so therefore people might do this. I do not judge that line for each individual where they decide it's not going to be enough for me anymore. And morally, we seem to see them as different in that typical suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Assisted death is a permanent solution to a permanent problem, which is a great line, I thought. So I did then ask about the conscientious objection thing. Would you feel like you would consider declaring it? And it split pretty evenly between yes, no, and I'm not sure yet, which is typical, I think, among a lot of professionals. And then do you feel you would need support if you did feel like you might have to make a conscientious objection in this? And vastly, people said yes, that they would want to be able to talk through it. And this is where the processes, the policies, are needing to be well thought through. And then we said, what do you want from the college that might help? So things like guidelines and standards and position statements, please tell us what's right and what's wrong. So the expectations the college may have, the OT role, supportive resources for conscientious participation and objection to help initiate and foster conversations around this. So it's about making this happen in a really just way, in a safe way, and in an open way so that nobody has to feel bad about it. And then continuing education resources, like a handbook or an online module about the legal things, the criteria, the roles, clarified. I need a really good place to go and double check it quite quickly, which I do too. Resources that would be helpful to the client as well as to the OT. So a lot of places have produced FAQ documents. There's a really neat little brochure that Island Health has got to explain it in brief detail. And then support documentation around both participation and objection so that you can make sure it's easily documented. And then what else might you need from COTBC? Resources to support the conversations, ongoing education, and a written overview of what should be considered in these contexts. Please also, college people, advocate for the OT to have a role in end-of-life care. It's in the client's best interests to engage in meaningful occupation at end of life in terms of quality of life. But there isn't funding for that, unfortunately, in a lot of places. Advocate to have OT part of the interdisciplinary team that advises clients who are considering MAID. Education on clinical approaches and resources, and a forum or a focus group, maybe like this one, for OTs to debrief and further discuss these issues. So I think those kind of fora could happen through the college itself, or it could happen through more local contexts, which would be quite good. What I'll just say is that we'll shift to the panel now, but I'll also say that if anybody wants, at any point in time, you can feel free to email me. There are so many really useful resources out there that are audio resources, visual resources. I can make my slides available to you. I'll just take out the ones that might be copyrighted or something, like pictures that aren't mine. But the information is all just up there. And I can email it to you. And my email address is very easy, and I got my cards. So it's just utoronto.ca/kevin.real, which we'll give you later. But we'll go back to the questions.
All right, so it is time to open up the floor for questions. I want to thank you guys very much. We have about 20 to 30 minutes or so for questions, and I'm hoping there's some good ones out there that you guys have saved. We have the lovely Cindy, our deputy registrar, who has a mic over there, as well as Mary Clark, who's the director of communications in the Quality Assurance Program. So that we can hear your good question, I'm going to ask that you put up your hand and somebody will come to you and give you the mic. And if you can say your question right into the mic, that way your question gets recorded for all of our colleagues who couldn't make it today and they want to listen to it later on the website. So we will go ahead and get started. And we have about 20 to 30 minutes. Raise up your hand nice and high.
Hi. I was really interested to read the for your clarification where it says that you may speak to people about this and give them information. At an information in service that I was at in my health authority, we were told quite clearly that we weren't allowed to speak to people and give them information and that we had to direct them to our physician coordinator. So that would be one of those things that I would like to have some support and clarification written from the college about to support us to be able to have conversations with people. And I'm wondering, I guess my question is, why would we have a direction like that? Or maybe we were in process still of not being able to speak about it.
I'm wondering if it's that difficult conversation of you kind of need to have the patient raise it first. That's the issue. Otherwise, you run the risk, I think, of looking like you're aiding and abetting. So that may be what the discomfort was. I suspect, I mean, this is new, really new. And as much as we've got to be all on the same page and have this sort of marvelous collaboration, it started in May, right? So I think that as we have more experience, comfort, certainty, like what have we learned, what went wrong, we have to have that reflective piece. And because all of the oversight and monitoring isn't owned by the health authority, it's really owned by the coroner's office, and they haven't done that yet. That we've been told it should probably happen before the end of this calendar year, but that's probably what it's about, because I think that we all feel a bit more certain that you're kind of on the right track when the patient has clearly said, well, what about this? Then that it's a different conversation. But I can't speak for OT, but that's sort of my sort of wearing a regulator hat kind of thing.
Just on the point of it being so new, I've had several conversations about it's a lot easier to move forward slowly than it is to go ahead fast and then draw back. So I think in particular for the regulators, it's even just getting the feedback on volume, how often, what practitioners are involved. Is it becoming a bit of more of a, not a specialty practice, but there are a few known practitioners in a health authority who are managing those requests. And so we don't know if that's what it's going to look like in the future. So I do think health authorities are being thoughtful about not putting pressure on their staff to go to this extreme, potentially, without some clarity and some clear understanding what the process is going to look like at that employer level. So I'm not surprised to hear that, and I think it will change over time.
I have a critical care colleague in Toronto who understands the yuck factor and the hesitation to raise this as a potential among the goals of care, but then turns it around and says, how are we actually assuring ourselves that our clients are giving informed consent about what we do plan to do if this has never been raised? And it's a kind of curious thing because you sort of think, who in Canada doesn't know about this right now? But it's a little dance that people do, and that is something that they'll learn to do better over time. The other thing that what we've done in our ethics discussion document and what we're doing in a lot of the policies that I know my colleagues are writing now is distinguishing between what we call informal inquiries and formal requests. And it's unfortunately the case that we can't easily track the informal inquiries, which is where a lot of where I work now, the care coordinators and even the personal support workers have to respond to informal inquiries. It's when it becomes a formal request that the paperwork starts trailing in, then it becomes something that's easily documented and we can track it over time. So, yeah.
Just in terms of the college piece, I think we don't have a position yet. I think we don't know what that looks like. So today is about getting information, understanding from our BC Health Regulator colleagues that are in the middle of this in terms of trying to set those standards and figure out what it's about. We have the luxury, I think, when I look across the country, of having a very integrated and good BC Health Regulators collaborative, which means I don't see why we would be developing our own statements aside from those other team members that would be potentially involved with the kinds of clients that we know occupational therapists deal with all the time that are at the spectrum where they might be thinking about. And the flip side of that coin is what occupational therapists can do to support the quality of life and being informed about what some of those other options are, not just about dying. So I would see us trying to figure this out with our other colleagues and certainly working closely with those that have the most responsibility in the area. In terms of employers, I think I agree with Cynthia that they're trying to manage this because the public, it is like May till now, that's rocket speed. And for a societal change, that's pretty massive. So I see us, this is the sort of a first step of figuring out what that looks like and trying to start with education and information and being quite clear about what those roles would be and what that looks like when you're in the middle of it. We have been getting practice questions already. There was one yesterday at our board meeting about, am I allowed to go help for that 10 days because I've been sent in to do something with walkers and safety supports, and am I allowed to know that they've asked for, that this is the 10-day comfort period? So this stuff is happening, and I see us making sure we do collaborate and work with both you and health authorities and certainly our fellow regulator colleagues about how this looks to help provide the best advice we can.
I'd like to thank you very much for this presentation. It was really good, and I'm really glad we had that spectrum of ethics as well as registration and college and ideas around representing legislative developments. My observation is that the legislation has finally caught up with what a lot of practice was already doing, legally or not legally, but I would regard it as compassionate care. But I have to say there's one thing that really concerns me about the legislation, and that is related to, it feels like the people that wrote all live in cities where there's lots of people around. And there are lots of different healthcare practitioners around. But there are many communities in Ontario and British Columbia and across our country where they're lucky to have one nurse, or they're lucky to have one physician there. Or it's a physician and a nurse and one of the pair is dying. And the ability to have the second person available is very, very difficult. Even in the event of being able to do it remotely, you still need a second person available. And I think we need to reflect on some of those rules and some of these legislations in the real situations that people are in.
Yeah, in much the same way that it's really hard to get hemodialysis in, name your small community, right? There are those really real access issues. Having said that, I can say that there are a cohort of practitioners, nurse practitioners and physicians, who are quite prepared to fly around the province. Having the care coordinator housed in each health authority, and as we have more people who are trained and competent and can do all of that, I think that some of the workarounds and some of the rural access issues are being addressed. I think the numbers have been more than people anticipated. So, you know, I look sort of for Alberta Health Services, whatever resources they've had, they've had to double it. And that's not just for the provision of MAID, but it's also all of the, like, cause remember, there are a whole bunch of people are going to want to talk about it. They may actually even sign the paperwork and then change their mind. But that doesn't mean you don't do all of that work behind the scenes. So I think we may have underappreciated that autonomy that patients expect to be able to have this in that choice. We do need to look at resources. It needs to be in the context of good end-of-life care more broadly. But as regulators, we're obviously not in the access business, nor are we in the sort of supply and demand business. But from a regulatory point of view, we've tried to be flexible enough to, within the confines of good care, make things like telehealth support this. So
the other thing to say is that the way that we've actually been framing it anyways in our discussions in Toronto and around Ontario is that we need to try to make access equitable. And one of my co-authors on that discussion paper is a physician who's both an eMERGE physician and a family physician, and also somebody who flies into rural and remote communities 4 or 5 times a year and is effectively the family physician to 4 or 5 small communities in northern Ontario. So she was brilliant at being acutely aware. There's also the difference when this is happening in the community, in people's homes, and then long-term care homes, and how that is made equitable or not. So we recognize that it's there. But the other thing that we recognize is that whilst it's important to do it as soon as possible because of the reason being it's about suffering, it's not an emergent procedure. And nobody sees this as something that requires an emergency response. There are other things for that. That said, we don't want it to be as protracted as it might be if it's not easily done. And that's why the telehealth option helps things do a little bit better. But even in Toronto, I got a phone call yesterday from work. A family who's trying to sort somebody to sign the request on behalf of their family member who can't do it themselves, who's independent. Two witnesses to witness the signing by the signer. And then a separate assessment from another healthcare professional who's qualified to do the assessment of eligibility. And it sounds like it's not that much, except when you've got somebody who's in a lot of pain in front of you and you're trying to do this without having to tell the entire circle of friends what's going on right away in the hope that one of them will say, okay, I'll witness, and one of them will say, okay, I'll sign. And so it's actually bizarrely more complex than I thought it was in some cases. In others, it's been perfectly fine.
Right. Thank you. I had a practical question, you guys, about, so we talk a lot about resources and education for clients and for caregivers. Right now, I know there might not be the best available, but I'd like to be able to provide something to clients and family that has no jargon, that's like layman's terms, easily accessible for, you know, grade 5 reading level. Is there anything out there right now that explains this sort of stuff, or are we still working on it? I'm just curious, because I think that would be really helpful for a lot of populations, especially culturally sensitive too. So like we get lots of different cultures, especially in Vancouver, right? I work with a lot of Chinese and Indian populations and just everything, like the whole gamut. So I was curious, as of right now, what would be the best resource to direct families to so they can start to understand the complexity of it all, right? Because it's not an easy issue for people to wrap their heads around, and they're obviously very emotional, right? Friends and family are. I would say when I've worked in acute care and in long-term care that the families are almost more affected than the clients themselves, right? That it's really hard on them and all that grief. Yeah. So if we can give them really clear, concise, easy-to-read stuff, that would be awesome. Thank you.
We don't have anything.
Nope.
But the health authorities might, and I know for Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, there's a MAID care coordinator, and that's who I'd contact. I know that there's a web address and an intranet MAID care coordinator.
All of the health authorities have one, or the regional health authorities. And I think, again, it's the whole newness of this. It wasn't like the perfect launch would have been, you know, branding exercise, brochures translated into 40 languages, all that stuff. I think that will come with time. And also I think just the depth of understanding within the public sphere about what this actually means. It's a culture shift. I mean that broadly in the context of Canada.
There are some emerging good resources, I would say. And I have to confess that the trouble is that you're always going to probably be the best resource for the family that you're working with. So get your own sense of what this is about clarified and chat it through with other people so that you know how to talk about it quite clearly. But there are some good leaflets out there. This is the Island Health Authority has a very good little leaflet on it. In fact, the Government of Canada's website has a very relatively accessible document about it that just goes through everything that's there. If you go to the Joint Centre for Bioethics at the University of Toronto, there is an FAQ document there for clients and families that we've been updating prior to the legislation being changed and whatnot. It's being beta tested with patients and families as well, so it might evolve and become plainer. So there's stuff out there. It hasn't yet been kind of refined to be particularly culturally sensitive, I don't think, anywhere, because that will become something that I think individual members of various particular cultures and microcultures might have to do. So, yeah.
My voice booklet. It starts the conversation of values, personal values, what's important to you at the end of life.
So that's the Ministry of Health
My
booklet called
Voice.
My Voice.
And you can Google it, and it's in doctor's offices, it's in libraries, and it starts the conversation.
And there's also, to the same end, again, not just about MAID, but about end of life in general, the entire set of resources available through Speak Up. the advancedcareplanning.ca website. April 16th every year is a National Advanced Care Planning Day. I'd like to challenge OTs to all do their own advanced care plans before they try to do it with a client. Yeah, that's out there as well, which is, I think, in the same vein as that. And it doesn't just focus on, it doesn't talk about MAID, but it talks about goals of care.
Just a quick question. I had heard some discussion on CBC just around, or my own thoughts, how do we actually measure a reasonably foreseeable death? And it was in the context of someone who's been mentally ill for many years and the difference between physical disabilities with maybe something like ALS and how it takes away your independence and quality of life versus someone who has particularly been mentally ill for many years, has tried everything, but still has a wish or a need in terms of end of life.
There are sort of three broad areas within the current legislative framework where medical assistance in dying, they're not eligible, and the sole indication being a mental illness is not. The other one are pediatric patients, and then the other one is advanced directives. So there was one court-authorized medical assistance in dying that occurred in Alberta during that time from February to June, which had as a sole indication a persistent serious psychiatric disorder. But the federal legislation makes it quite clear that that is off the table. And what they have promised is something to study and bring back in 3 years' time. So just bias. You know, prior to joining the college, my family practice involved a lot of looking after people with serious persistent mental illness. And you're right, we always judge how ill they are by what their suicidal ideation is. So it's going to be a tough one for somebody to grapple with. I suspect this is going to be litigated in the courts. There's going to be court challenges, and that's why we have people who've been elected or people who get to be judges make really tough decisions. Good news, we don't have to make them.
You can be mentally ill and still be capable, but it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and that's where the major yuck factor lies for a lot of psychiatrists with whom I've been working for years at CAMH, that I think for the first time now, the assessment of capacity in that context, if it were legal for somebody who has solely a mental health related life that they're calling intolerable because of the psychological suffering, if I, as your psychiatrist and then as a second assessor, find you capable to make this decision, it feels like a very direct line to your death, which is a very different thing to the most analogous thing, which is that I might find you capable enough to be released from hospital when you've been brought in after an attempt at suicide. And if you go out afterwards and you then either attempt again or complete it the next time, it's not quite the same direct line from my assessment of capacity, which is it feels profoundly distressing. And it's also just, it's a totally different mindset in psychiatry where this idea that the recovery approach, that everybody can find a way to live with their mental illness if we just keep trying to do the right thing and combine things. That's kind of got everybody happily embracing hope endlessly. But there are some stories of people who say it's just not enough, sorry.
Thank you again for opening this important conversation. My question relates back to culture, which we were just touching on, and I'm wondering if any of you folks or anyone else in the crowd has heard if there has been consultation or conversation among different cultural groups and particularly our Indigenous peoples, and if there has been any place for our Indigenous persons to say what matters to them and how their cultural perspectives play into MAID and this legislation.
First Nations Health Authority has been engaged as a health authority in the conversation here in British Columbia. And I think for most of the colleges, I don't want to speak for everyone because they're not all here, cultural safety and cultural competency is a foundation in terms of our expectation of a professional. Certainly within the nursing curricula, we expect that it is foundational. I think medicine as well. Yes. Yeah. So in terms of the actual impact for society, I think that's a conversation all British Columbians need to have. But in the context of care being provided, first, FNHA has been privy to all of the work that we've done so far. I don't know, Heidi, have they been any different as a health authority? No, it's pretty even, Stephen. The cultural implications are broad, of course, and that's why it's patient-centered care, because we need to be thoughtful and respectful of cultural needs of the client, so, or patient.
Good morning. I have more of a, I guess, a comment rather than a question. I'm an occupational therapist and a lawyer, and I'm part of a committee for the Trial Lawyers Association of British Columbia. Our upcoming medical legal conference in January of 2017 actually centers around this issue. And I don't know if it's reassuring or not, but it's a big issue within the legal community and within the medical community, and we haven't sorted it out. So if you're here and you're feeling very unsure, just know that we're all unsure as well. Chief Justice Hinkson is going to be speaking at our medical legal conference, as well as there will be numerous presentations by physicians and lawyers with respect to those same questions about the line of what is imminent death. And I suspect, as has been mentioned by the panel, that this will be an issue that's going to continue to be litigated and clarified over these upcoming years. I just think the most important thing as OTs is that we stay attuned to kind of where that process is going, and it will eventually get clearer, and it's just great to hear that that conversation is beginning to happen now. So thank you.
Thank you for raising this conversation, and thank you to COTBC for hosting you and asking you to be here. I continue to be appalled by the Margot Bentley case in the Fraser Valley because it seems like they don't understand reflexes. And secondly, it's an issue of justice and fairness. And so my question is, to what extent, and this is for anybody on the panel, you want to comment on it, to what extent do you think religious values are impeding access to MAID? Kevin, earlier you alluded to the fact that in Canada we have this idea of publicly funded religious institutions, which I think is an oxymoron. So if you could, any of you could speak to that.
This gets back to reconciling individuals' right, for want of a better word, to conscientiously object, but understanding that patient autonomy and lawful healthcare services kind of are on that other side. And, you know, somebody who practiced medicine for a couple of decades, and I worked at a Catholic hospital, I worked at a couple of non-Catholic hospitals, and yeah, we kind of made it work. I mean, you just knew that patients weren't going to get tubal ligations there, but they were going to get them there, right? And we just, it worked. And people kind of, like, the health, it works around the health system, right? That it does, and certainly our own Minister of Health has said, why would we expect St. Paul's Hospital to provide this service? Mm-hmm. Well, no, but again, just reconciling that. But the quid pro quo is, then it can't be a barrier to accessing care. Mm-hmm. And if it starts to look like it's being used as a barrier, or people are blocking, or people are, you know, being mischievous about this, or not being mindful of that ethical and professional obligation to recognize and respect patient-centered care, client-centered care, autonomy, justice, all of those other bits that are that ethical framework, then I think you'll see the healthcare system moving to do those kind of things that people are already a bit of a bellwether about, which is, so then if the institutions aren't getting it right, then the institutions may find themselves that option is off the table. Mm-hmm. And for individual practitioners, there may then be a public interest that requires referral, those kind of things. So I try to be careful that we are trying to reconcile and make it work. Time will tell if that's going to be the way that it is, but it is, I'm always grounded in what's in the patient's interest, what's in the public interest. And as I said, the fact that my patients couldn't get their tubal ligations at a particular hospital didn't affect their care.
My reflection is it's a question for our politicians. It's our question for all of us as society. So when you think about the number of significant changes in terms of healthcare delivery, abortion is another issue that remains still, I don't want to use the word divided, but, you know, in terms of religious facilities offering or not offering services to clients around specific procedures. I think what drives that kind of change is societal expectations. And we can, as regulators, certainly respond to that, because as it is, as Heidi said, our job is to protect the public interest. And so as the public interest or their interests shift, their focus shift, then we respond to that.
I am addicted to the news in parts because I always have to get up in the morning and decide if I can wear, you know, stripes or checkers or not, because whether or not I'm going to be on
yeah, don't worry,
or somebody's calling for my resignation. You know, you had one branch of the Catholic infrastructure saying, you will not attend for last rites, you will not offer. And then within 24 hours, another bit saying, well, we're doing it a little differently. So, you know, I think that everybody has their own bellwether, where they're going to focus. And I just think that, I guess I'm always optimistic. And we can make it work. And if we all bring the patient's best interest to the table, we can make it work.
I think I've got a quick question around clients with dual diagnosis that have a concurrent severe physical disability and have a secondary diagnosis of a mental health issue as a result of their disability. So one example that comes to mind is somebody that's a high quad that has exhausted their options and have worked for numerous years to have care in place. And we've explored all of those options for care. But then, despite having those options for care over several years, they've got an ongoing mood issue related to their condition. And with that comment earlier around mental health diagnosis is excluded in the legislation, how does that fit? Because sometimes that mental health diagnosis is secondary to the physical condition. And how does that get dealt with in the face of this legislation?
I'll start on this, and you can correct me when I'm wrong or what I miss as well. But part of it comes back to what I refer to as which twisted ticket you got in the perverse lottery. So if your spinal injury is high enough that you can't breathe independently, you can just withdraw your life-sustaining treatment, and it's done. And hopefully it's done in a very wonderful way with sedation, so you don't get air hunger and panic attacks and that sort of thing as you struggle with your last breaths. If your spinal injury is not that high, then you're not eligible anyways. So the fact that you're living with a mood problem constantly that makes your life intolerable above and beyond the fact that life's harder in many ways because you've got a high-level spinal injury, you're just not eligible under the law as it is. And there is a wonderful, incredibly heart-wrenching story of a bioethicist in Salt Lake City, Utah, named Margaret Pabst Batten, who wrote about assisted dying for decades. And then I think in 2007, her husband had a very high-level spinal injury. And suddenly she was living this kind of terrible tragedy day in, day out. And it's been written up in the New York Times, the magazine, and she's written about it again. If anybody wants to read more about it, I can send you the links and the documents. But she reflects a lot on this, and her husband talks about wanting to die for repeatedly, but never gets there until finally, after I think 4 or 5 years, he suddenly gets there. But he can just withdraw because he's got a C2-3 injury. And so it's not a matter of assisted dying anyways. But yeah, it's very, the other things that get very complex in mental health are both conversion disorder, where the person has such profound physical ailments that they may actually end up in a position where their life is threatened because they've stopped eating or something like that. And also, of course, anorexia, where there are many legal precedents in various countries where somebody with anorexia, the team has decided to stop treating after many years of trying to treat and seeing the person as somebody who's got a terminal illness. And whether we would say at some point somebody like that could qualify as a natural death in the reasonably foreseeable future.
I just want to add one thing. What Naz was just articulating, this scenario, is exactly the case scenario that we're exploring within the Trial Lawyers Conference. That's exactly the kind of individual, the kind of patient that personal injury lawyers and the medical team and OTs often end up encountering. So it's really quite relevant that you bring up that type of client.
And what a number of people have commented on is it's not clear that Kay Carter, the eponymous Kay Carter of the Carter decision, she wouldn't necessarily qualify under this law because she didn't have a terminal diagnosis. Her natural death was foreseeable more because she was quite old and frail, but not because of spinal stenosis.
I have a similar question related to mental health realm. Just wondering if there's been conversations around mental health certificates and capability assessment. And I guess my question is a little bit reversal, where you have a client that is certified under the Mental Health Act in BC, develops a possible illness with a foreseeable death. Would the process be similar, or due to the kind of the criteria, would it be a different or more kind of onerous process for them.
A scenario might be somebody who's detained in an institution under the Mental Health Act, so extended leave provisions, who then goes on to develop a horrible end-stage esophageal carcinoma. What are their choices? You get the lawyers involved.
But the thing to remember there is that, at least I know the way that we've been talking about it under the Ontario law, is that you're looking at an assessment of capacity that isn't about global incapacity necessarily. It's about treatment-specific and decision-specific capacity. So we spent a lot of time trying to imagine whether it's possible that somebody could be incapable for a host of treatment decisions because they don't apparently understand and appreciate everything to do with it. But on this one, they might. And that's a really scary thing to try to have to tease out because, as I said, that capacity assessment could be the kind of direct line. Next week, I'm with a colleague presenting a seminar at the Joint Center for Bioethics where it's kind of similar. It's somebody who the client's story, which is based on stories we've experienced, is somebody who has had long-standing depressive illness and bipolar borderline personality disorder and attempts a suicide herself, and it's incomplete. Unsuccessful and ends up in ICU on life support and physically very damaged by this and probably cognitively damaged. And the question is, do you follow the substitute decision maker's request to not proceed with life-saving interventions? Or if you do that, are you basically at risk of feeling like you're completing somebody's suicide for them? Because the person's not capable because they're unconscious.
And I believe this will be the last question we're able to take this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if there is any information or insight about, from insurance perspective. I work in home health, and I have had clients asking me when they have a young family and they have terminal illness, that if they pursue this way, would it affect their life insurance? Because mostly, if natural death is the option, then there is insurance coverage. But in this case, would it be considered otherwise?
Call your lawyer, but again, what I would say is, and this is not legal advice because I ain't no lawyer, but it's what I've heard lawyers say, which is that this discussion was had at length in the drafting of the legislation and the idea of this whole thing becoming decriminalized. And effectively, at the moment anyways, because natural death is reasonably foreseeable, there's a kind of apparently an understanding with insurance companies that this is going to happen anyways, and this is about mercy, and that there should not be any effect. But that said, many people have various ways of describing insurance companies that might suggest a different approach. So I have no interest in any insurance company.
Wow, what great questions you guys all had, and I'm sure there might even be some more. So if you do have some questions, Kathy, we'll be coming up here in a moment, but make sure you mark those questions down if you have any outstanding questions. So it's now time to move on to the final section of today's pre-AGM session. I'd like to introduce Kathy Corbett, probably a familiar face to most of you, the Registrar and CEO of COTBC. Kathy will lead a discussion and kind of revisit anything else that you might think you need from COTBC and go from there. So welcome, Kathy.
I am conscious of the time, so my job that I was tasked with, aside from thanking my friends here up on the panel, are there any sort of burning thoughts that you have in terms of leaving the college with your expectations and impressions of what you'd like us to do? We could have a couple of those comments, but I'll also direct you to the evaluation forms on the table. We do look at that feedback and consider it closely with future planning. So that's a good place for us to get some of your information. Are there any burning thoughts about from what you've heard today that you want to provide at least your thoughts about how the college should be approaching this before I would do some closing remarks?
I was debating whether I should say it or not, but I'm still not comfortable with the conversation that during the counseling, the medical team counseling the patient who is considering assisted suicide, especially regarding severe disabilities or the progression of the disease. When we are talking about quality of life especially, I think we can bring to the table a value perspective of what that disease may look like as far as the impact on function. And I think this is where OT, I think, can play a big role by counseling the patient this is the practicality of life for you if you choose to continue. This is what we can help you with. Is this a life that you could bear? And I think, with all due respect to the medical team, but I'm not sure if they would know the details of what life is going to look like with a certain disability, with a certain progression of a certain disease. And I think we can bring a lot of value by explaining the practicality and the details of life, and that's informed consent. For them, we can have the best guess based on our training of what that look like and let them make that decision versus, because I think a lot of it is fear of, oh my God, I don't want to be disabled, I don't want people to take care of me, et cetera, and et cetera. But I think if we can be more objective about what life could look like and let them make that decision, I think this is a new field that we could contribute to uniquely. But I think we need to be at early on stages of that conversation rather at middle or towards the end of it.
I'm delighted to hear your comments about collaboration and to see the collaboration happening between the regulators. I think there's also opportunity here for collaboration around the regulators' role, around the professional associations' role, around the role of the educators, around the role of health authorities. So there's room to collaborate, I think, across all the aspects of organizations that support the profession, and perhaps this is a place for Occupational Therapy Canada to provide forum for some of these discussions to happen.
Thank you. Maybe I'll ask the panel members to just make a comment or two, because I think what's important for me when I get my head around this is that this isn't the first conversation that's happening when the clients or patients or residents or family members you're dealing with. This isn't about at the very beginning, or if it is, then that's the conversation that needs to engage the team. And I think what I heard Cynthia, Kevin, and Heidi talk about are about what that team piece looks like. What is the collaborative information that helps that family become informed? And while OTB is not the primary person that's doing that initial conversation, the contributions of other team members to what that looks like. So I think it's kind of beginning with the learning part about what this is. And this isn't the first conversation you have when someone has their injury. It may be, but you get the right folks involved. So I think it's kind of where on that continuum this conversation happens and what the responsibility and information if I'm thinking of Heidi's remark about the physicians ought to know more than just what they're doing, but what other things are possible to help that person be informed about that level of decision. So I'm not sure that triggers any other conversation, Cynthia or Heidi. So I appreciate it. I think that it speaks to those values and being clear that it's a difficult topic. And just in terms of closing, today is about kind of that opportunity to hear from experts, people that are living and breathing it. I hope if you go away with any message, we as a college always seek out expertise and resources. I have great respect and I'm honored to have two fantastic colleagues to work with the BC Health regulators, because there's experience and the collaborative energy that exists around our BC Health regulator colleges, so all the other health profession colleges, is quite strong, and I think we should be tackling some of these conversations together. So that the collaboration you heard about, how the alignment with the College of Pharmacists, College of Physicians, and College of Registered Nurses around how they're setting the information and communication with health authorities and their practitioners they regulate. Similarly, the other regulatory colleges, we should have similar messaging around how we deal with those questions when they come up. We certainly know as a college occupational therapist in many contexts are going to be likely on the front lines of hearing some of this conversation, and the first step is getting to know it, lifelong learning around this particular topic of having good information. So misinformation isn't out there, and myth-busting is kind of part of that role, and seeking to have those conversations collaboratively with your colleagues. And we're in the rural, remote areas. How do we in turn set up those connections and networks that I think we've heard about today? So it's my absolute pleasure to thank Cynthia Johansson, Dr. Heidi Otter, and Kevin Reel for participating today.
Thank you very much.